Welcome to Stuart Hall in Conversations. I'm Ben Carrington. Who was Stuart Hall? Why is he important? And what can his ideas teach us today? In this series, we'll explore the life, work and legacy of a thinker that some call the last of the great public intellectuals, and a figure widely credited with being the founder of cultural studies. This man is Stuart Hall. Through conversations with his former students, colleagues and friends, we'll seek to better understand this seminal writer and academic.
He has a real insight into the power of policing, which we are very much wrestling with in the United States.
I don't think Stuart ever dumbed anything down. He just said, you're equal to me and you will understand this. And then you did.
Stuart Hall's legacy lives on because the questions live on.
Today, I'll talk with Les Back, Professor of Sociology at Goldsmiths College, University of London.
Stuart was never a person to have a kind of formalism or a view or a convention. I still find his ideas and the things he was struggling to understand incredibly vital and urgent.
I caught up with him on the campus of Goldsmiths College, outside a building where a quote from Stuart Hall greets every student and faculty member that walked through the doors. It reads, quote, "But this experience of, as it were, experiencing oneself as both subject and object, of encountering oneself from the outside as another, an other, sort of person next door, is uncanny." End quote. Professor Back, can you tell me a bit about this building and the naming of the building?
Yeah, I can tell you a bit about it. This is what was called initially the new academic building. There was the new building for the Media and Communications Department, a department which housed many people who worked closely with Stuart Hall. And after Stuart passed, there was a kind of groundswell amongst the staff there, people like Dave Morley, Angela McRobbie, Julian Henriquez. And it just felt like it was the right thing to do to sort of apply to the university or just promote an idea to the university. Wouldn't it be great to honour Stuart by naming the building after him? Because what your listeners won't be able to see is that the Stuart Hall building as it is now, the Professor Stuart Hall building as it is now, is on one side of a postage stamp quite large green, which in the old days was called the backfield, now is called College Green. So on one side of College Green we have the Professor Stuart Hall building, and on the other side of the building we have the Richard Hoggett building, which was renamed in Hoggett's honour.
And Richard Hoggett was one of the key founding figures of cultural studies.
No, that's right. And, you know, it's a wonderful story about the relationship between Stuart and Richard Hoggett. Richard Hoggett was responsible for bringing Stuart Hall to Birmingham, where they were so involved and important in developing the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, which the University of Birmingham was a bit ambivalent about, to be honest with you, and probably was ambivalent about it throughout its extraordinary life. But they were really the key figures which created a space for a kind of interdisciplinary intellectual environment where, you know, new issues around understanding the politics of class and of gender and of race and of post-coloniality became possible in this pretty conservative institution. So the fact that at Goldsmiths here we have Hoggett on one side of the green and Stuart on the other is kind of fitting, I think. In fact, you know, after Stuart passed away, Dick Hebdige came here to speak, who wrote the very famous book Subculture, the Meaning of Style. And I remember walking around the square with Dick, and he said it's kind of fitting in a way that Stuart and Richard should be on different sides of this divide, connected, not exactly under one roof, but in the same place. And I think he's right about that.
And they were very different people in some ways. So Richard Hoggett was a white working class lad from the north of England.
Exactly, yeah.
Stuart Hall was a black West Indian from Jamaica, middle class background, but they kind of met on the field of cultural studies, as it were. Actually, you could even say they helped to produce and to create the field of cultural studies.
They certainly were key in the shaping of what cultural studies became. Both figures that emerge in the sort of post-war era. Hoggett himself, you know, was not a theoretician. He was a scholarship boy. You know, he was a grammar school boy.
What does that mean, a scholarship boy?
Well, you know, he came from a working class community, and in those days, you know, for working class kids and working class boys particularly, you know, the choice was between taking an exam that would get you into a grammar school, that would get you a kind of white collar, possibly white collar job, or from going to a secondary modern school. Secondary modern schools were for manual trades, basically.
Okay, so this would be quite early, so maybe at the age of like 10, 11, 12 years old.
11, yeah,
children in Britain would be kind of put on one path, which would lead to like a working class type of job or middle class, is that right?
So your fate was decided at 11 years old. Can you imagine that? How brutal class divisions were in those days.
Not that and what, day, what period are we talking about?
Well, we're really talking from, I mean, Hoggart, that would have been in the 1930s and 40s, you know. But that system continued right through to the 60s. There's this generation of grammar school educated, working class boys largely, who found education and shaped it for their own purposes. Hoggart was one of them, Raymond Williams is another one of them. Both figures that are important in the formation of Stuart Hall. Now, Hoggart really was somebody who used his own biography to try and make sense of the way in which British culture was changing. Whereas Hoggart always thought of him as a theoretician. He was somebody who had a kind of theoretical and a theoretically trained mind and was a political political activist, you know, a key figure in the New Left. And in a way, both Hoggart and Stuart Hall were a good team in that sense. So you had Hoggart's feel for popular culture and what was happening in communities in Britain. At the same time, Stuart Hall, a scholarship boy who comes to Oxford, you know, from Jamaica, theoretically trained, incredibly insightful interpreter of British culture. You know, he comes kind of from the outside, comes in that sense as with a view of someone from outside who can see things that those people who are sort of born and bred in the culture are completely blind to and oblivious to. And the fact that them together was a really powerful combination, I think, in the formation of cultural studies.
Yeah, and we're here, as we said, on the campus of Goldsmiths College at the University of London, and you're a professor of sociology here at Goldsmiths.
Yes, I mean, I find it hard to take it seriously when you say that, but that is actually true, yeah.
And Goldsmiths, in many ways, has been one of the key centres in the United Kingdom for the, what we would call a kind of a British culture studies approach.
Yeah, that alongside legacy, sociology. I think, you know, it hasn't always been comfortable for the institution, but I think more and more so. So, you know, Paul Gilroy taught sociology here for many years.
He was a professor that spent some time in America.
Yeah, so Paul, you know, was a student at the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies in Birmingham. Wrote his PhD there, very important classic book, which was published in 1987, The Ain't No Black in Union Jack, which is about the politics of race and culture in the 1980s. Paul then leaves Birmingham, comes to London and works, and ends up as Professor of Sociology at Goldsmiths. And when I came to Goldsmiths, Paul was a professor in the department. I don't think he was quite a professor yet, but he was working in the department. So it became a kind of place where, you know, there were British cultural studies tradition, as it became, was alive in sociology, but also very much within media and communications. Figures like Dave Morley and Angela McRobbie and so on, again, had been connected to the centre in Birmingham. So, you know, in a way, Goldsmiths has become a place where that the legacy of that thinking has been sort of reproduced and gone on to new kinds of formations, new sorts of agendas as well.
And did Richard Hoggart and Stuart Hall have any kind of formal relationship with Goldsmiths?
Well, yeah, I mean, Richard Hoggart, actually, I mean, I was a student at Goldsmiths in the early 1980s. Richard Hoggart was warden of the college when I came here. I mean, he was an extraordinary man, actually. I didn't quite figure out how extraordinary he was at the time. So he's warden of the college. He's like the equivalent of a principal in the US.
Or president.
Or president. He's the president of the university, and he's still teaching undergraduate students classes in English literature. Can you imagine? I mean, he had a great commitment to the idea of education, which went back to the workers' education movement of the 20s and 30s, the idea of education could be a collective highway. Mm. Stuart was in that sort of formation as well. I mean, I think they both were deeply committed to the idea of the transformative power of education. Mm. So, you know, no surprise that that trace, if you like, and that sort of history would be one that is very powerfully alive here at Goldsmiths even today.
And did Stuart Hall ever teach here? What was his affiliation with
him? I think he had an emeritus connection here. He was a regular visitor, you know.
So emeritus would have meant like when he retired from Open University.
Right. That's right. He had an honorary position here, I think. And it just felt like the right thing after Stuart. I mean, you know, it's hard to overestimate how powerfully effective the terrible news of Stuart passing was, you know, for so many people. I mean, the thing that really struck me was that even those people who never met him felt a deep sense of loss. You know, it was almost like the kind of interpreter of our world, or how to make sense of the complex post-colonial nature of British society that interpreter had left us, you know. And there's a lot of people who felt a tremendous sense of sadness and loss. He had that capacity.
And did you know Stuart? Did you ever meet him? What was your
relationship? Yeah, he was. I was lucky enough to meet him and get to know him and collaborate with him, work with him on projects. You know, when I first met him, I was a very impressionable graduate student. I remember going to a seminar full of all kinds of, you know, youthful anger and rage at the world. And I remember this. I don't remember the name of the person who was presenting, but the person who was presenting I wasn't very impressed with, and Stuart sat there in his way that he did, and he kind of took things in, and I was sort of bristling to myself and scribbling angry notes on the page. And Stuart just turned to me and he said, you're not even impressed by that, are you? And immediately my sort of, callow rage was punctured, and it made me think harder about exactly what it was that I wasn't impressed with, and to think more carefully about why. And he had that capacity.
And did you know who Stuart Hall was at that moment?
Yeah, of course I did. I mean, he was like he had an extraordinary reputation, but he was on the one hand a giant of intellectual and political life here, but at the same time, he wore it so lightly. You know, you'd be sitting next to him, and he would just be another person at the seminar, and he would ask a question, and it would be like, not with any great intellectual grandstanding or the apparatus of the performance of intelligence, and none of that. He would ask a very plain question. It would often be quite concise, and it would often, almost always, be very searching.
And that's quite rare within academia, especially amongst the big figures, the big names within academic life, where there's a certain performance of self. You're saying that Stuart didn't really perform
in that way. He did. He was a first class version of himself. That's what he was. Mm-hmm. I don't think he had any time for the trappings of academic status. I just don't ever have that impression of him or a memory of him. But he was a deeply serious thinker, you know. He was really passionate. And, you know, later, one of the best things, and perhaps is the best thing I'm ever likely to do, is I had an opportunity to contribute to a collection that was about Stuart's thought. A friend of mine and ours, in fact, Claire Alexander, asked me to be involved in this collection. And she said, would I write something about Stuart? You know, I was a deep student of his thought and of his writing. You know, I'd met him several times. I admired him. I was a bit sort of, on the one hand, felt strong, very warmly towards him and affectionate towards him, but also kind of was a bit scared about being too familiar, you know. So I was a kind of close and distant at the same time. She said, would I write something about it? And I said, well, no, because, you know, no one's interested in what I've got to say about Stuart Hall, least of all me, but I'm interested in what Stuart Hall's got to say. So I said to her, well, why don't I arrange to go and have some talks with him, and out of that dialogue something brilliant will come, which it did, actually.
And he also agreed to do it. I mean,
yeah,
there's a way in which many big name academics are kind of hard to approach, and there's something in it for them. So how did it actually come about, and how did you approach him?
He had a tremendous sense of intellectual generosity, particularly if he thought, you know, you were doing something that added to the conversation that he wanted to have about the issues of the day. You know, it was always incredibly humbling, because when you were in conversation, we'd say, oh yeah, of course, you've written about that, or he would mention something that had signaled the fact that not only did he know who you were, but he knew what you cared about and what you'd written about that as well. So he had that, and it's a special quality he had. So how it happened was that I just contacted him and said, you know, Stuart, been asked to do this thing about you. I don't want to do it about you. I'd rather do it with you. And he said, yeah, immediately, let's come round. And initially, I have to say, I was a little bit scared. No, I almost shied away from it, because I thought, well, that's a pretty precocious thing to expect, that you can sit down and reason with Stuart Hall. And in the end, I got over myself, and we had fantastic hours and hours of conversation in his home in North London, you know, with a pot of tea with a very brightly coloured tea cosy. Your American listeners probably won't understand the symbolism of that, but sitting down with Stuart Hall, reasoning with endless pots of tea and talking about the big issues.
And just so a tea cosy, that's a...
It's like a woolen hat.
..device that you put around...
to keep it warm.
Yeah, to keep it warm, because you're having so much tea over an extended period of time.
Yeah, having so much conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was an extraordinary man to be in a conversation with, because you really felt you were in a conversation with someone. Mm-hmm. You know, with someone of a kind of formidable intellect. But that's how he operated, how he worked as an intellectual. I think it was always a joint project for him. I mean, many of his publications were you know, collective ones, and he had that capacity. He had a capacity for intellectual generosity, but he also had a capacity to draw people into a conversation that was bigger than themselves, and even bigger than him, even, you know.
Yeah. And so this conversation was eventually published in the journal Cultural Studies.
Yeah.
And it was named At Home and Not at Home.
Yeah.
Could you explain what the At Home and Not at Home...
Yeah, it was something that struck me after our conversation, and Stuart immediately went with it. So, you know, Stuart comes from Jamaica. He comes out of a colonial culture in which the politics of shade are very brutally imposed, you know, the sort of shadow of colonial power.
And when we say the politics of shade, what
well,
what
so, you know, in the as an effect of the British Empire, you know, what emerged in particularly in Jamaica was a kind of hierarchy, which was a hierarchy of shade, of shadism almost. You know, so the lighter... those colonial subjects were, the higher they were on this hierarchy of shade. And in his own family, I think he was darker than some of his relatives and so on. He didn't talk about it when we met, but he talked about it subsequently, how much that had torn his family apart, actually. So he'd come from this kind of context to Oxford, you know, the high table of the English class system, right? He's both, you know... completely committed to the life of the mind, fascinated with English literature, but, you know, in place and out of place at Oxford, comes to London. He starts making a living close to where we're standing here in South London, in a secondary modern school, one of those working class schools, teaching kids, you know, geography, being taught by Stuart Hall geography in the late 1950s. Anyway. So that's his kind of formation. And he makes a life here, really. And he, in a sense, makes a kind of an agenda for his own thinking here, initially through his engagement with the New Left and the new politics and understandings of division and class here, and then, as an extension, an understanding of the black experience in London and in Britain, not in the Caribbean, in Britain. So, you know, in many respects, he was the greatest interpreter of English life or British life that lived in my lifetime. Yet he was not, he always felt, that's partly where he was, both at home here, an incredible interpreter of English culture and English life and the politics of post-colonial London particularly. At the same time, he never felt at home within it. So that's that at home, not at home.
Yeah. In that interview that you do, that you conducted with him, at one point he says the following. He says, "I realise that almost everything I write is a kind of political intervention. It may not be about politics explicitly, but it is trying to shift the terms of the debate, intervene on one side or the other, clarify something, wipe some other distorting views out of place so that something else can come through." And he continues talking about his work. "There are interventions in the field rather than autonomous scholarly works." What's Hall getting at there? So he's kind of making, it seems like he's making a distinction between his project, which is about political interventions, rather than like the kind of formal scholarly contribution.
Well, it kind of chimes with what I was trying to describe before, you know, his generosity and his collaborative impulse and ethic, you know. So it's intervening in a situation, changing the terms of the debate, not as a sort of singular, brilliant academic scholarly mind with, you know, high citation indices and all the rest of it. No, he's trying to intervene in a situation where people are reckoning with the terms of how we understand the culture, you know, the dynamism and the changing nature of forms of power, how the us and the them are being inscribed by the legacy of colonial racism, and images of the other, you know. So he's intervening in a way as part of a general collective conversation, and then that conversation isn't about agreement. It's not about agreement. It's an intervention with a sense of purpose that sometimes is opening things up, sometimes is setting out stark contrasts actually between the logics of different positions. And I think, and he had also, he was a brilliant teacher. You know, he spent a lot of his professional life at the Open University. You know, the Open University, for US listeners, it's important to remember that's a university that's really taught via the television and via taped lectures. So it's distance learning. It's distance learning that is open to communities who can't afford the cost of full-time education. You know, it's part of that legacy of workers' education, you know, the collective highway. And he had an incredible capacity to capture in one small symbol the huge historic story. So, you know, he tries to undermine the idea of small island Englishness or Britishness. My God, that's made a comeback lately. Through saying, well, you know, let's take the symbol of the cup of tea. Where does the sweet traces of sugar that rots the young people of England's teeth come from? It doesn't come from the green fields of Surrey. You know, it comes from the plantation societies in the Caribbean. Where does the tea come from? You know, they aren't growing it in Essex. You know, so do you see what I mean? He had that capacity to take something small and suddenly think, wow.
So it's to take almost like an everyday cultural object and to subject it to a kind of a social, political, even kind of economic analysis.
Yeah, he thought that every aspect, I think, you know, my sense of Stuart was that he was fascinated and enchanted with almost everything that was popular. You know, he wanted to give that, and that's where he's cast in the same kind of spirit as Hoggart. He wanted to take popular magazines or TV shows, you know. He was a lifelong devotee of Neighbours, the Australian daytime soap opera, you know. So you would go and have a conversation with Stuart and you'd be talking about, you know, Foucault and philosophy, and the next minute you'd say, oh no, I've just got to catch up with Neighbours, you know. Because he felt that, you know, in those popular arts, as Hoggart would have had described it, there was a big public political issue so often that it was passing as banal triviality. Mm-hmm. Something was happening within the sphere of everyday life that was really about how the society functioned. Yeah. And its mechanisms and its levers, if you like.
And there's a part in the interview that you did with Stuart where he goes on to say that one of the key things that his work tries to do is that he says, quote, I'm interested in the conjuncture. I'm a sort of writer. So he says, so in the interview that you did with Stuart, he goes on to say that his writing is kind of informed by this notion of conjuncture. He says that I am interested in the conjuncture. He refers to it as trying to write the history of the present. This has come up a few times when I've spoken to people about Stuart Hall's work, this notion of conjuncture.
Mm.
And it seems to be an important part of his method. What does conjuncture mean? How might we understand that?
In simple terms, and you know, I'm looking up at the sky and say, forgive me, Stuart, if I'm getting this wrong. But I think in simple terms, what the notion of conjuncture tries to point us to are those lines through time that are significant points that shift us into a different kind of historical moment. You know, the thing about Stuart, and it's his debt to Marxism, I think, he's a profoundly historical and historically informed thinker, always. You know, so it's not just what's happening in the present is what's important and the past is past. That's never the way that he worked. He's always thinking about, well, what is it about the present that in a sense demonstrates a particular kind of quality of human society and culture, you know, and when do those moments begin and when do they take hold? You know, so lots of people throw around, you know, lines through time, you know, 9/11 is one of those shorthands. Well, you know, Stuart was interested in something that was more than a kind of, you know, a political gimmick. He was interested in those big moments of historic transformation. So he places the beginning of our present, if you like. At the moment when Thatcher and Reagan come to power, we have a different kind of global capitalism developing and a different kind of state formation that also accompanies this global interconnected phase of capitalism.
Yeah. And so as we stand here outside the Stuart Hall building, there's a group of young guys playing football, soccer, kicking the ball around, using the space in between as a leisure space.
Yeah.
But off into the distance, we can see Canary Wharf. We can see some of the buildings associated with the city. And Canary Wharf was really a kind of a physical manifestation, if you like, of Thatcherism and the kind of redevelopment of previously working class areas in a dock area that now have major, often American, multinational companies. So in some ways, that this very kind of space here will be something that we might begin to see these
connections
between.
We can look across the college green that separates the Stuart Hall building from the Richard Hoggart building. We see, as you say, these kind of cathedrals, these towers of neoliberal capitalism that have sprung up.
Citibank is actually one of them, and
HSBC. HSBC, that's right, and Canary Wharf Tower, which has got lots of different corporate interests there. But what we see, what we can't see between where we're standing and those skyscrapers, is the docklands of London and the Thames, which was the jugular vein of empire, that fed, in a way, Joseph Conrad begins, the Heart of Darkness on that waterway, that starts here, at this dark place of London, as he looked back as the night was falling to the heart of Africa. And in a way, the city is built on that colonial moment. But the industrial order, which grew out of that imperial experience, has almost crumbled. Or it has crumbled and it disappeared. 100,000 jobs lost within a space of 10 years in Dockland, London. And the communities that were formed around those, profoundly inflected by social class and many things that were about that sort. And Stuart would have been absolutely attentive to that. Mm-hmm. What happens in that situation? And much of the work of cultural studies in that phase, was trying to make sense of the industrialisation and what it was doing economically, but also culturally for young people. So in a way, it's a perfect landscape for us to think about why those ideas and why that tradition of thinking is still alive, vital, and important for us as a resource to make sense of not just the history of the present, but our experience of the present.
So we're going to walk now towards a pub.
Yes, indeed.
Appropriate enough for London. And Stuart Hall was one of the first people to actually coin the term Thatcherism, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
In the 1970s, he kind of foresaw some of these changes.
No, he foresaw that, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that... There were two important things that Stuart really understood well. And the first thing was that, part of the new kind of global capitalism that was emerging, which in so many respects used free market rhetoric, that alongside that, and it intertwined within it, that wasn't sort of, that wouldn't necessarily lead to a withering of the state. What happened, in his diagnosis, was rather a strengthening of the state, or what he called an authoritarian populism.
And so the populism was to appeal to popular sentiments, maybe to kind of appeal to the broader working classes, but alongside that was a kind of a strong kind of law and order kind of discourse, is it?
Exactly. Even before he coins the phrase Thatcherism, he writes a very, very, very important book, which is so relevant to us now, with a group of postgraduate students at the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies.
So he would work with graduate students?
Oh, yeah. He worked very, very closely with graduate students, called Policing the Crisis. And what Policing the Crisis did so brilliantly was to show how a moral panic around a certain kind of racialised crime and how the idea of the mugger travels from the US and comes to Britain and becomes a kind of symbol, if you like, of that law and order society. He doesn't coin the phrase, he doesn't really develop the phrase. He coins it in Policing the Crisis, but he doesn't develop it later in terms of his analysis, until later in terms of his analysis of Thatcherism. But he shows how the work, that form of racism is doing, not only to exclude those post-colonial migrants and their children, but what it's doing to actually manage the consensus and relations of dominance that are established within the society. So that is the vehicle through which the crisis is policed.
So he's connecting changes within the economic structures of society with the phenomenon of a particular type of crime, mugging, alongside questions of policing, alongside questions of changes to the nation state. Yep. I mean, there's lots of things going on there. There seems to be like a multi-dimensional analysis.
It's an audacious, extraordinary, bold critique of how the culture is turning, you know, and a diagnosis. Now, you know, it isn't often... I mean, sociologists, he said this himself, sociologists really are able to predict anything with any kind of confidence or advocacy. Accuracy, I should say. But what they did, what the Policing the Crisis Collective did, was to predict the world that was coming, actually. You know, they picked up on that conjunctural shift, that tipping point in history, very early, and anticipated, you know, in large part, the history of our moment.
That's quite a contribution.
Yeah, an extraordinary one, you know, so that's why... I still think, you know, we've just gone through another kind of moral panic in a moment of crisis, you know, that supplants the figure of, you know, the sort of post-colonial mugger or, you know, the British-born black youth with the figure of the, you know, of the immigrant and the globally mobile person. You know, it almost feels like a replay of... Not exactly, because the nature of the historical moment has shifted, but it feels like a replay of a similar kind of process, you know.
Yeah. And I guess many of these concerns around the immigrant, the other, refugees, concerns about what that will do to the body politic, the desire to keep out other people, will be very familiar to American audiences right now. So
no,
given with the kind of the rise of Donald Trump and some of the rhetoric around putting the great back into America again, wanting to build a border building a wall soil on the southern border. So, do you think there's? Would you say there's resonances or ideas that Stuart Hall articulates or concepts which would help to make sense of the American condition?
I think there are things that he anticipates or the direction of travel. I think maybe we've got more work to do about what's happening now. Actually, I think that it's not. There are traces of that legacy, but something else is happening in our moment, which I still think we're struggling to come to terms with, you know. And the sort of legacy... One of the things he said during that interview that you kindly mentioned, you know, he said... that it stuck with me. I just thought, this is such a deep observation that, you know, the culture here still lives off this reservoir of unconscious racism. You know, that's deposited there by the history and the legacy of empire. It's a deep reservoir. It's unspoken. But, you know, and maybe it's unspoken and unconscious because it's about empire and because it's about race and racism. But it doesn't mean it's not alive in the culture. It's incredibly alive in the culture, whether or not it announces itself or speaks its name or not. And I've thought a lot about that recently, that sort of... nostalgic, melancholic almost sense of attachment to a sense of greatness, you know. It astonishes me. And it's very, very hard to reckon with politically, partly because of its effective grip. You know, I remember after the Brexit vote, you know, Britain has just voted to leave the European Union, the account of a van driver who's stopped in a motorway service station, and you'll recognise this scene. So he stopped in a motorway service station to sit down to his quintessential, iconic, you know, breakfast, an English breakfast, you know, fried eggs, bacon, not the crispy kind that you folks have over in the States, you know, beans, these strange things, the English breakfast. And he says, you know, with great passion, this is my first English breakfast in England. And I just said, it really caught me short. I thought, how bizarre and strange. He probably had that breakfast a week or so in. Is that the same, exactly the same spot? You know, and was that not in England? But something about these attachments to, you know, that imperial sense of nation and race, I would say, that is incredibly powerful and alive in the culture. I just thought, well, weren't you in the same place last week? Wasn't that still in England?
So part of the discourse was the notion that if you voted to leave the EU, you could take your country back. So was that the
we
kind of
want
the
our country back?
Yeah.
That was the great cri de coeur, the cry from the heart of the Brexiteers. You know,
and that very similar language is being used in the US right now by Donald Trump. That actually this is an attempt to make America great again and to take our country back. So actually the language is almost identical.
Well, it is, and it's deeply troubling. It's back to what? Back to what?
And from whom?
And from whom?
Yeah.
And who do the people who feel so vulnerable in themselves, you know, who do they think is taking their country away from them? I mean, I think we're really struggling to find a language to engage with this and make sense of it.
And does that make Stuart Hall's passing even more painful and difficult because he's not around, or
well,
is there a responsibility,
you know,
for the
I
rest
think
of us
in honest
to
truth,
do the work?
You know, I think towards the end of his life, and it was again a sort of symbol of the kind of man that he was, that he felt like the world was getting away from him, actually, and that there were so many things he couldn't quite get his head around, you know. And you thought, blimey, if Stuart, you feel like that, what chance for the rest of us? Yeah, but I think what he had, the qualities of his thinking live on, partly because of the nature of his craft as a thinker, you know. So he was an incredibly generous intellect. At the same time, he was a committedly collaborative one. So the trace of his thinking, I think, lives on in all those people who have either been moved by his thinking and his example, as I know people like yourself have been, and I certainly think of myself in that category, but also those people who were lucky enough to work with him.
Yeah. And your first book in 1996 was called New Ethnicities and Urban Culture. Was that kind of a homage, or was that
Of course it was. You know, I mean, I've said so many times, but it bears saying, you know, I'm not a post-colonial figure in a way, although I'm very much the product of a post-colonial context, you know. So I don't have an experience of migration or the kind of experience that Stuart Hall had, you know. At the same time, Stuart Hall did more to explain to me what it meant to be of this culture and in this society than anyone else. He was the greatest interpreter of what that experience was, even though he wasn't part of it, even though he was at home here and not at home here at the same time. So, you know, there was no greater interpreter of Britain's post-colonial condition than Stuart Hall. And so in that sense, it's, you know, when he introduced that notion of new ethnicities, you know, the changing quality, if you like, the changing dimensions of experience and the connection of the here and the elsewhere and all those things that he gifted us as ways of making sense of what was going on, of ways of making it sense of what was happening when you were sitting, you know, at your kitchen table in the morning drinking a cup of tea, what it meant, what it was connected to, what its traces, what traces were alive in those tastes, you know. No greater interpreter of that. So, you know, in a way, it made total sense to me because he was providing the best interpretive devices and tools to make sense of the experience I cared about the most.
And so what would you say to those who might suggest that Stuart Hall is a fig of the 1970s and therefore his work and his ideas have become obsolete, that we live in very changed times and that he may have made important contributions in the 1970s and maybe the 1980s, but he's locked into that era, and that we shouldn't really turn to Hall for any understandings of the contemporary conjuncture?
Apart from being rude and swearing, I would say read. Think harder. Try thinking. Try thinking with Stuart. Stuart was never a person to have a kind of formalism or a view or a convention, you know, or he wasn't somebody who built intellectual empires. He just didn't do that. That's not what he was interested in. He was interested in making sense of things with others, through others. And I still find his ideas and the things he was struggling to understand incredibly vital and urgent, you know. What did he say in that conversation that's almost 10 years ago now? Well, he said, you know, one of the things he was transfixed by were the globally displaced people. This is before, you know, the so-called migrant crisis. This is a decade before it. He was transfixed by those people who felt compelled, given the conditions of their existence, to smuggle themselves into the undercarriages of airplanes and fall out of the, you know, the airspace above us here in London, or for that matter, to smuggle themselves across dangerously in leaky boats, you know, or, you know, on the Mexican border, that dangerous adventure of trying to smuggle yourself across the border. You know, he was transfixed by those figures and those characters because he knew intuitively that was a big part of the 21st century story. So, you know, in many respects, he was a very attentive and a figure who really, he anticipated the line of travel within any particular historic moment. So, you know, I think those people who say he's so 1970s, they're just flat wrong.
And what would you say to an American listening to this as to why they should read Stuart Hall, find out about Stuart Hall? Is he relevant to the American context, or is his work kind of located specifically in terms of understanding politics within the United Kingdom?
Well, I think that translation or that resonance happened a long time ago. I mean, I think there are many figures working in the US context who were struggling to find a more international, global sense, or, you know, to put it in more accurately, to think in the spaces between nation states. I think that already happened. That happened a long time ago. I know it wasn't smooth, but there's a conversation going on, and there has been for a long time. You know, what can be learned from those diaspora intellectuals, you know, who are, you know, at home in nation states and not home in nation states? You know, I think you said to me many years ago, which really made me think hard, you know, at the time when there was a struggle over making a version of Britishness that could be open, you could be black and British. That was never a real political issue in the US, was it? You could always be African American or black American. There was never any ideological struggle around that. It was what condition that placed you in within the context of society. So, you know, I think there's many figures who are sort of border intellectuals in many ways. To go back to Edward Said's idea, the legacy of those ideas are useful across, you know, the Atlantic context, and I think those ideas are very alive there. I mean, I would just say to American listeners who are curious, just pick up a book and read. You know, I'm betting that there would be something of resonance and relevant and useful in his ideas. You know, he was somebody who made interventions, and it was because of that they always had a sense of purpose, and therefore they were so often really useful forms of knowledge.
And useful forms of knowledge isn't always a thing that academia produces. So,
well,
what was his relationship to academia? Was he?
I remember he told me in that interview, which I always love. You know, the principal, if you like, of the Open University contacts Stuart and says, Stuart, you know, are you willing, would you be willing to profess sociology at the Open University? And he said, you know, in a sort of wonderfully sort of ordinary, practical way, he said, I'm willing to profess anything if you're willing to pay me for it. I just thought, what a fantastically brilliant answer. None of the pomposity of all of the, you know, my disciplinary, you know, status and all of that nonsense. You know, he had none of that about him, I think. He also thought, actually, and worried deeply towards the end of his life about what was happening to the university. Because the university was a place for somebody like him. And many people, you know, a whole generations of people, where you could find a kind of intellectual space to try and make sense of what you thought mattered. And, you know, I think he had a very deep commitment to the idea of the university as a critical space, not a political space, a space that could connect to politics, provide a space to think about political issues with openness and with a deep sense of self-criticism, you know.
So he had a quote or a phrase once where he said something to the effect of that a university is a critical institution or it is nothing. Actually, just where we were before we walked down here, we've just left the Goldsmiths campus. But that quote used to be up in the Stuart Hall.
Yeah, that's right. We had an exhibition of his writings, and including some of the images from his early publications. The critical university is the university is a critical space or it's nothing.
And it seems right now in both the US and the UK, especially the public university, the state-funded university, yeah, and the very idea of universities being spaces of higher learning for everyone seems to be under attack right now. And it seems
it's really under attack. And I think we've got to be braver. And I think we've got to be haunted by Stuart's ghost and animated by the way he would have acted in that context, you know, and be bloody-minded and not be willing to compromise on some of those things. Because I think he's absolutely right. The university is a critical space or it's nothing.
Do you miss Stuart?
Yeah, of course I miss him. I miss him every day, you know. It's not that we were so close, but somehow the world, a world without Stuart is a world without a kind of something that you can plot your bearing by, you know, or that you can take counsel from, or that you can look to, someone you can look to for clues.
Yeah.
Or look to for somebody to provide you with a resource to try and make sense of the, you know, particularly or peculiarly specific preoccupation that might be driving, keeping you awake at night, and that you think is really the most important thing there is going on, you know. So a world without him is a poorer world in that sense, you know. A world which doesn't, without those kinds of, without that, you know, extraordinary talent that he had for giving you things to animate your life differently, to see things differently in your life and in the life of others.
I guess one of the good things, and maybe this is a good place to conclude, one of the good things about Stuart Hall's writing, and this picks up on the title that you gave to your interview with him, is that when you read Stuart, you hear his voice. So
yes,
for many people that are going back to his writings, in many ways you're still in a conversation with Stuart Hall, I think. David Scott, the anthropologist at Columbia University, makes this point well, that when you read Stuart's writing, you hear him.
Yeah.
And he writes in a way which is almost like he's given a lecture, like you're kind of talking and discussing. So even though he's not around, you can still go back to the printed word of Stuart and to hear him, to listen to him, and to kind of be in dialogue with him, not just to be on the receiving end.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Reading Stuart is to be... is to hear that spectral voice. You can almost... What you can't hear was his playfulness always, his tremendous sense of humour. You know, when I was doing the interview with Stuart, one of the things that posed me the biggest sort of problem was, well, what do you do with all the laughter, you know? What do you do with the laughter? Because there was so much laughter in a conversation with Stuart about things that mattered, even though some of those things could be deadly serious. So sometimes the laughter was sardonic and ironic, you know, and a sort of chuckle, which was a chuckle at, a laughing at the powerful and those who are, you know, heaping damage in our world and on our world. And sometimes it was just plain joyous, you know, laughing at a beautiful insight or a connection that was just made that was a product of that conversation that wouldn't have been made without it. So that's what I miss the most, if I'm absolutely honest with you, Ben. I miss that.
Well, our conversation as well has taken us to the streets, the high streets.
Of New Cross. Or the low streets.
Yeah, as you can hear in the background. And a very working class part of London as well, historically.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're standing right here, Ben, and across the street was the place in 1977 where the National Front planned to march to mark. In fact, it's very fitting given our conversation, planned to march against muggers.
And who were the National Front?
The National Front were a racial nationalist, openly racist political movement that had very strong support in this part of London. So 800 National Front right-wing extremists plan to march through these streets, and literally where we're standing, across the street over there at the top of Clifton Rise, which is where the march was stopped by a combination of local people, an alliance of local black communities with political activists and anti-racists who descended on this part of London from all over the country to physically stop racists from marching. So it's kind of fitting that we should end here, really.
On a note of resistance.
On a note of resistance before we go and drink a pint of beer.
Perfect, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Perfect.
Les Back is a professor of sociology at Goldsmiths College, University of London, who has been a leading figure in creating a new form of sociological research sensitive to the ideas of race, ethnicity, identity and culture that animated much of Hall's later writings. Coming up in the next conversation, I'll talk with the editor-at-large for The Guardian, journalist Gary Young, about why Stuart Hall was such a powerful figure as a public intellectual, and why his soft and nurturing presence spoke louder than many of the more well-known thinkers of the late 20th century.
You've been listening to Stuart Hall in Conversations, presented by Ben Carrington and produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, with special thanks to Maggie Tate, Anima Ajapong, Jake Perlman, and Todd Callahan. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy. Thanks for listening.